Side 15, The Boat of a Million Years by Paul Anderson, continuing on page 439. Her laugh rolled. Also my belly. Their second. Pregnancy was not disabling. Bodies had hardened to Xenogean weight. But you had better be careful. Don't worry, we'll pitch in to see your man through, and maybe you won't be gone long. Soberly. Take what time you need, though. This means a great deal to them. It might mean everything to us. Therefore, Aliat packed her gear and rations and departed. Coming out of her house in the morning, she stopped for a minute and looked. Not yet was the scene too familiar to see. The sky reached milky, an overcast riven in places to reveal the wan blue beyond. Nowhere beneath were the clouds that should have brought rain. Air hung still and hot, full of sulfury smells. The stream that ran from the eastern hills through the settlement had become little more than a trickle. She barely heard it fall over the verge nearby and tumble to the river. Down in the estuary, banks and bars shone wider than erstwhile at low tide. Regardless, Hestia abided. The three homes and several auxiliary buildings stood four square, solidly timbered. Russet native turf between them had withered, but watering preserved the shade trees and the beds of roses, hollyhocks, violets along walls. A kilometer northward, robots were busy around the farmstead and in the fields. The meadow and its cows made a fantastic vividness of green and red. Farther off, the spaceboat reared above the aircraft hangar into heaven, like a watchtower over the whole small realm. From this height, Aliat spied a brighter gleam on the eastern horizon, the amethyst sea. We'll survive, she knew. At worst, the synthesizers will have to feed us and our livestock till the drought breaks, and next year we'll have to start over. Oh, I hope not. We've worked so hard, machines too few, and hoped so much. An enlarged base, surplus, the future, the children. All right, I have been selfish, not wanting to be bothered with any of my own, but isn't Hestia glad that I'm free today? Elsewhere, Manoa reached as of old. South, across the river, forest crowns bore a thousand hues, ochre, brown, greenish-bronze, dulled by dryness. The same growth bordered the cleared land on the north. Then, westerly, on this side, hills climbed. Above their ridges lifted a white blur, Mount Pythias wrapped in its mists. Human names. Throat and tongue could form the language of the dwellers after a fashion, understandably if they paid close attention, but soon grew hoarse. The concepts behind that speech were more difficult. Aliat turned to kiss Dushan goodbye. His body was hard, his arms strong. Already at this hour he smelled of sweat, soil, maleness. Be careful, he said anxiously. You be, she retorted. Xenogea surely harbored more surprises and treacheries than had struck thus far. He'd been injured oftenest. He was a darling, but drove himself overly hard. He shook his head. I fear for you. From what I have heard, this is a sacred matter. Can we tell how they will act? They're not stupid. They won't expect me to know their mysteries. Remember, they asked if somebody would come and what? It wasn't clear. Help? Counsel? Judge? They haven't lost their awe of us. Had they not? What did a creature not of earth, no kin whatsoever, feel? The natives had certainly been hospitable. They readily gave this piece of ground, and indeed offered a site closer to their city. But the humans feared possible ecological problems. There had been abundant exchange of objects as well as ideas, useful as well as interesting or beautiful. But did this prove more than that the Ithagene, another Greek word, had their share of common sense and, one supposed, curiosity? I've got to go. Keep well. Aliat walked off as fast as was safe under a backpack. She developed muscles like a judo black belter's, which gave a terrifically sexy figure and gait, but bones remained all too breakable. Someday we'll leave. Phaeacia waits, promising us to be like Earth. Does she lie? How much will we miss this world of toils and triumphs? Four Ithagene waited at the head of the path. They wore mesh mail, and their hook halberds gleamed sharp. They were an honor guard, or so she thought of them. Deferential, they divided to precede and follow her down the switchbacks across the fjord wall to the river. At the floating dock, the envoy was already in the vessel that brought them. Long, gracefully curved at prow and stern, it little resembled the two human-made boats tied nearby. No more did it have rowers, though, and the yards were bare of sails. A motor, such as the fabricator robots had lately accumulated the resources to make, was an imperial gift. Supplies of fuel renewed it ongoingly. The humans often wondered what they were doing to this civilization, for good or ill, ultimately to this world. Aliat recognized Saa. That was as closely as she could render the name. She did her best with a phrase that they guessed, in Hestia, was half formal greeting, half prayer. Lo responded in kind. Lo, le, la. What else could you say when sexes were three, none corresponding quite to male or female or neuter, and the language lacked genders? She and her escort boarded. A crew member cast off. Another took the rudder. The motor purred. They bore upstream. "May you now tell me what you want?" Aliat asked. "The matter is too grave for uttering elsewhere than in the halidom," Saa answered. "We shall sing of it." The notes keened forth to set an emotional tone, prepare both body and mind. Aliat heard distress, anger, fear, bewilderment, resolution. Surely much escaped her, but in the past year or two she had finally begun to comprehend, yes, feel such music, as she had failed to do with many kinds on earth. Wanderer and Makandal were experimenting with adaptations of it, composing songs of quiet, eerie power. You wouldn't have thought of these beings as artists. Barrel torsos, some 150 centimeters tall, on four stumpy limbs, covered with big scales or flaps, brown and leathery, that could individually lift to show a soft pink undersurface for fluid intake, excretion, sensing. No head to speak of, a bulge on top where a mouth underlay one scale and four retractable eye stalks protruded. Four tentacles below, each terminating in four digits that could be stiffened at will by Turgor. But how repulsive did a body look that was scaleless as a flayed corpse? The humans took care always to be fully clothed among Xenogeans. Rapidly driven, the boat passed several galleys bound the same way, then numbers of lesser craft, fishing or freighting. None were going downstream. The tide had begun to flow, and although the moon was fairly distant today, the bore up the river would be considerable. At ebb, the argosies would set forth. This was a seafaring nation, whose folk hunted great aquatic beasts and harvested great weed fields, traded around the coasts and among the islands, occasionally fought pirates or barbarians or whatever their enemies were. As tactfully as possible, the six at Hestia refused to give any military aid. They didn't know the rights or wrongs. They only knew that this appeared to be the most advanced civilization on the planet, but someday they'd want to start getting acquainted with more. Of course, doubtless their local friends had found uses both warlike and peaceful for what they acquired from them. A pair of hours slipped by. On the south side, forest gave way to orchards and croplands. Foliage drooped sere. On the north, while hills heightened in the background, bluffs declined to gentle slopes. Towers came into hazy view, grew clearer, loomed sheer above masts crowded along the wharfs. and Aliot went ashore into Xenonosis. Warded by stream and fleet, the city had no need of outer walls. Along wide, clean streets, colonnades and facades rose intricately sculptured. Glass flashed in color patterns of contrasting simplicity. The effect was not busy, but harmonious, airy, like trees and vines in wind, or kelp in currents under sea, strange to behold on a world that dragged so heavily. The raucous turbulence of human crowds was absent. Dwellers moved deliberately. Even the looks and remarks that followed Aliot were decorous. It was their voices that danced, twittered, strove, joined together. Their voices, and the sounds of instruments from places where they took their pleasure. Not all was thus. Climbing a hill, she saw down to a camp outside the city, a wretched huddle of makeshift shelters. The beings within stood ominously bunched. Armed guards were posted about. Chill touched her. This must somehow be the reason she was called. On the hilltop fountained the building she knew as the Halidom. Its stone had weathered pale amber. Nothing like its interwoven many-branched vaults and arches, spiral windows and calyx eaves were ever on earth. Imagination yonder had never ranged in those directions. When the images arrived, architecture, together with music and poesy and much else, might well have a rebirth, if anybody still cared about such things. Saw accompanied her inside. A chamber vast and dim opened before them. The mighty of Xenonosis had gathered, expectant, in a half-circle before a dais. Thereon were those three, one of each sex, who reigned or presided or led. Hearing tell of them, Hanno had from space proposed dubbing them the Triad, but later those at Hestia thought a better word might be the Triune. She approached. That night she radioed back from the apartment lent her. She camped in it, really, as ill-suited as the furnishings were, but it served. A window was unshuttered to warm darkness, the booming of a breeze. The small horned moon tinted clouds and cast ghostly shimmers on the river. Fires burned sullen among the squatters in the field. Exhaustion flattened her voice, though her mind had seldom felt more awake. "We've been at it all day," she said. "Not that the trouble is complicated in itself, but it involves beliefs, traditions, prejudices, everything that's so knitted into a person. Think of a pagan Celt and a pious Muslim trying to explain, to justify, the status and rights of women to each other. The Ithagene did have the wisdom to ask for an outside opinion," Patulcius remarked. "How many human societies ever did?" "Well, this is unprecedented," Wanderer answered from the outback. "We never had any real aliens among us on Earth. Maybe in future we'll benefit. Go on, Aliot." "It's how they breed, copulating in fresh water, which must be still if conception was to result. A certain concentration of certain dissolved organic materials was essential. That set no more of a handicap on a world where most regions were normally wet than loss of the ability to synthesize vitamin C in the body had done for her species. You remember the city people used that lake in the hills behind town. Holy Lake became the human name, for it seemed lovemaking was a religious rite in this society. Well, throughout the hinterlands, most others have dried up to the point where they're useless. The habitants have gotten together and demand access to Holy Lake till the drought's over. It's badly shrunken, too, but enough is left for everybody if triples ration their turns." Aliot's laugh clanked. "How that would go over with our race. But of course the Ithagene don't think of it the way we do. What has the Xenonosians up in arms is the thought of outsiders profaning their particular mystery, the presence of their tutelary spirit or god or whatever it is. The Triune told the country folk to go home and wait out the bad times. They shouldn't breed anyway till the rains come again. But you know about the sacred year births. Yes, Dushan said. Besides, they live primitively. Infant mortality is always high. They feel they must be fecund, whatever happens. The realm, this whole section of Minoa, is close to civil war, Aliat told them. There have been killings. Now the tribes have jointly sent 2,000 or 3,000 here who insist that soon, come what may, they'll go to the lake. Nothing can stop them short of a massacre. Nobody wants that. But to give in could tear things apart almost as terribly. Akandal whistled low. And we had no idea. If only they'd come to us sooner. I don't suppose it occurred to them before they got desperate, Patulkius guessed. If we don't find a solution fast, I suspect it will be too late. That's why you went, Aliat. Makandal's tone wavered. I gathered from Sa's hints that it concerned this kind of thing, and you, with your experience, don't misunderstand. No offense, Aliat said. I did, I hope, slowly get a feel for what's going on, and a notion. It may be worthless. Tell us, Svoboda begged. If you could use human words for Ithaginian emotions and make sense, Aliat thought, then the assembly next morning was appalled. No, exclaimed the Lur of the Triune. This is impossible. Not so, foreseers, she maintained. It can be quickly and easily done. Behold. She unfolded a sheet of paper. Copied thereon, a transmission from Hestia to a machine she had carried along, was an enlarged aerial photograph of Holy Lake and its vicinity. The Ithagene didn't object to overflights, though none had ever accepted an invitation to ride. Did some instinct forbid? Was it a prohibition, or what? She pointed. The lake lies as in a bowl, fed by rain and runoff. Here, a short way below, is a hollow. Let us clear it of trees and brush, then dig a channel through the hill above. Some of the life-giving water will drain out to fill it, while enough will remain for you after the channel is closed again. There, out of sight of your people, the country folk can engender according to their own customs. For you, this would be a huge undertaking. But you know of our machines and explosives. We will do it for you. Hissings and rustlings fill the gloom. Sa'a must explain to Aliat, patching out the native language with what human speech Lo commanded. Although they are reluctant, they would agree, lest worse befall. However they fear the inhabitants will refuse, will take the proposal as a deadly threat. Knowing Kth and Krung, the leaders, I think this is true. For a life site is not any pond. It is hallowed by ancient use, by the life it has given in the past. To triple elsewhere would be to set the world awry. The rains might never return, or the violators might never have another birth. Dismay struck Whetted. You don't believe that. Not we who are here, no. But those are simple upcountry folk. And it is true that not all bodies of water grant the blessing. Many do not, though surely they were tried at some time. That is because... Oh, Christ, what's the use? Water flows from your eyes. Do you invoke? No, I... You have no word. Yes, I invoke the dead and the loss and... Wait! You leap, you raise your arms, you utter noises. I have a new thought. Maybe this will serve. I must ask the council. Then I must doubtless go to the habitants and learn if it feels right to them. Aliat turned around to face the Triune. For days, heaven had been almost clear, an iron-hard blue, clouds nowhere but in the west. Heat lightning sometimes flickered yonder, and thunder muttered into windlessness. Now sunset reddened those reaches. Its beams struck through gaps and down valleys until they splashed the new tarn as if with human blood. Trees bulked black against it. More and more the Ithagene, gathered in their hundreds, became masses of shadow, a wall around the water. Their singing beat like a heart. Out of them trod the eldritch ones, three couples, for it was known that that was their nature. On their right walked the foreseers of the city, lanterns aloft on poles to cast many-patterned light. On their left, torches flared and smoked among the sower chieftains. These halted at the marge. The six went onward. Aliat felt drowned turf crisp beneath her feet. The water lapped around her ankles, knees, loins. Warmth from the day remained in it, but a coolness was rising from below, a pledge to years unborn. "Here's where we stop," she said. "The bottom slopes fast. Farther on, we'd soon be over our heads." She couldn't fight back a giggle. That'd make it hard to go about this dignified, wouldn't it? "I am not sure what we should do," Dushan confessed. "Nothing much. We have our clothes on, after all. They don't know how we make babies anyway. But we must take our time and—" a sudden odd shyness— "and get them to see we love each other." His arms enfolded her. She pressed herself close. Their mouths met. Vague in the twilight, she glimpsed Patulcius and Makandal, Wanderer and Svoboda. The hymn from the shore reached into her. A necking party in a pool, she thought crazily. Ridiculous. Absurd as real love-making, as everything human, everything alive. We've sailed from those stars blinking forth overhead to stage a Stone Age fertility rite. But it was working. It consecrated the mirror. It kindled the magic. In peace would Manoa await the resurrection of the land. "Dushan," she whispered, straining against him, "when we get home, I want your child." 31. Joyful is the word that has come to us, related the Alos, whom the humans thought of as Lightfall. Share it. From rendezvous has it fared, the closest rendezvous, 147 light-years yonder. Many-branched fingers marked off a part of the sky, then closed on a point within. Made by a shape that looked so frail, limned against naked space as revealed in the transparency of the ship, the gesture became doubly strong. The direction was well away from Sol, but not toward Pegasi. The Aloi had roved widely from the world that mothered their race. "Rendezvous," said Yukiko, her force aloud and in a language of Earth. She was understood as she understood what was communicated to her. However, difficulties and failures of comprehension were still many. That was inevitable when minds could not translate directly what senses perceived, but must pass it through a meta-language worked out in the course of years. "I do not quite identify your reference." "Starfarers have established stations, orbital about chosen suns, to which they report their discoveries and experiences," Quicksilver explained. "These pass the information on to the rest. So do nodes of knowledge grow, and the beams between them form nets that piece by piece knit together." Hanno nodded. He had been aware of this. His explorations with Aloy companions had taken him near the vast gossamer web they had made to circle Tritus, while Yukiko was searching into their arts, philosophies, dreams. "There's a primitive version in the solar system," he reminded her, "or was when we left. After they start receiving our casts, they can upgrade it and join the community." "If they care to." She looked out to where stars drowned in the icy cataract of their own numbers, and away again with a slight shudder. What she and he had learned here gave scant hope of that. Hanno was less daunted. "What is this news?" he asked avidly. "A ship came to the rendezvous," Lightfall told. "All do thus from time to time, that they may take in the fresh data, for the stations cannot well broadcast continuously to those who may be anywhere at any velocity. Such of our report on this system as had arrived by then determined the crew on proceeding next to Tritus. We have encountered them before. It is clear to us that the Xenogeans hold special interest and promise for them. May we have an image? Provided, agreed Starwing, and activated a projector. A hulking form sprang forth. Hanno's immediate thought was of a rhinoceros. Granted, the resemblance was faint and fanciful, like comparing a man to a caterpillar. The body was of minor interest in any case, except insofar as it was the matrix of mind, of spirit. Yes, he ventured. They're from a big planet, too, aren't they? I dare say they see just enough cultural similarity here to themselves that they may reap a harvest of ideas from the differences. Yukiko's eyes shone. When will they come? Their message is that they wish to spend a few years at the rendezvous first, studying and thinking about the data, Lightfall imparted. That is usual, to take advantage of facilities that no vessel can accommodate. Doubtless they are on their way at this moment. Since they are accustomed to high accelerations, they should arrive just a few months later than their announcement that they have set forth. Several years yet, then, Yukiko smiled. Time to prepare a festive reception. Do they travel by the same doctrine as you? Hanno inquired. Yes, Lightfall answered, which we recommend you also adopt. I'm thinking about it. We need some basic modifications in our ship, you know. More in your thoughts. Touché, Hanno laughed. Conceded, we are impatient parvenus. The alloy did not boost continuously between stars. They got close to light speed, then went on free trajectory, using centrifugal weight. The saving in antimatter allowed huge hulls, with everything that that implied. The price was that time dilation became less. A journey that might have been accomplished in 10 shipboard years would take perhaps twice as long, and the farther you went, the larger the factor grew. All voyagers were ageless, but none escaped from time. The practice accounted for observers at Sol never having picked up sign of starcraft. Enormous though the energies were, radiation was only at beginning and end of a passage, a candle flicker, and starcraft were very few. "Perhaps you do yourself an injustice," suggested Volant. "Perhaps your hastiness will fill a need we older space-going races did not know we had. You may go beyond this tiny segment of the galaxy that we have reached, from end to end of it, in less than a million cosmic years. You may be those who weave it together." Yukiko's hands fluttered. "No, no, you honor us far beyond what we deserve." "Let us abide the future," flowed from Starwing, the patience of ancientness. These beings had left Pegasi 15,000 years ago. No individual lifetime of theirs was shorter than half of that. They knew of explorations that had been going on in other directions 100 times as long. "Well, this is wonderful," Hanno said, glancing at Yukiko. "Maybe you can find words, dear. I'm dumbstruck." She caught his hand. "You brought us here. You." They had become able to sense when Aloy turned grave. "Friends," Lightfall told them, "you must make certain decisions among yourselves. Soon after the arrive, we will leave." Through shock and suddenly racketing pulse, they gathered. "You may remain if you desire. They will be rapturous at meeting new members of the Fellowship. You can help them, and they help you, to know Xenogia and its awarenesses. Quite likely even more than you and we have helped each other. Everything that we have built in this system shall stay for your use."
But you go away," Yukiko stammered. "Why?"
Stalky limbs traced symbols. Membranes quivered. Opalescences ran over them. The declaration was calm, inexorable, and maybe, regretful.
"We have spent more than 4 centuries at Tritus. I believe you realize that was partly because of what we had detected from Sol. Our hope, which was fulfilled, that we could call travelers from there to us. Meanwhile, we explored these planets, and above all the diverse life ways, histories, achievements, horrors, glories of the sentients on Xenogia. It was effort richly rewarded, as we foreknew it would be. Another whole concept of the universe opened for us. Something of what we learned has entered our inwardness. and yet you humans in your decade and a half have gathered more than we imagined was there. It happens your home world, your evolution, more closely resembles theirs. Nature has better prepared you to comprehend them. For our part, we found ourselves drawn to you as never to them. You too are the kind of beings who reach for the stars. We could stay here till this sun begins to die and not discover all that there is to discover, for it is so much and always changing. Life is a rare thing, sapience more seldom yet. Why, then, will we not linger? It is that we hope for more than we have gained here, and we know that if we seek long enough we shall find it.
Hanno had nothing but merchant words.
I see. You've gone past the point of diminishing returns. Your best strategy is to start fresh.
As it seemed, mother civilizations did not, could not.
Will you go on to Sol? Yukiko asked unsteadily. Some day, perhaps, Starwing conveyed.
Likely or not, Quicksilver asserted, I think that what you have revealed to us will suffice, for they have been evolving onward.
Let Sol and Pegasi communicate, Volant scoffed.
No, you are too impetuous and too thoughtless of our friends, Lightfall admonished. We have years ahead of us in which to consider.
To the humans.
You too, with your kindred down on the planet, you must take thought. Do you wish to commence at once?
Hanno and Yukiko traded a look. Mutely she nodded. After a moment he did likewise. They bowed, one of many motions that had gradually acquired eloquence, and went from the Corallan room. A passageway took them along the great curve of the ship, past the part of it that was alive, stretched today, a simulated vista of ruddy hills, lean crags, fronds rippling around a frozen pool, beneath a violet-blue sky where rings arched like undying rainbows. A world the Aloy had once come upon and found beautiful, for it was much as their mother world was before the machines. They had left colonists. Beyond lay a room of exercise equipment made for the humans. It could be spun through a hollow ring around the hull to provide higher weight. Thus did they maintain a physical condition that allowed them to visit the planet without being too badly handicapped in relation to those who lived there. Farther on was their home section, Yukiko's little garden, a post upholding the model of a caravel that Hanno had once constructed, the compartment that housed them. Air inside it remained thin and dry, but it was warm, and to their eyes the lighting was pure white. The three rooms held their possessions, a few carried from Earth, more that were remembrances of their years here, but there was no clutter. He kept his sailor's tidiness, she her basic austerity. Opposite the electronic complex, a calligraphic scroll hung above a low table where a bowl of water contained a single shapely stone. They removed their outer garments.
"Shall I make tea?" she proposed. "Do, if you like."
His face drew taut.
"I want to call Planetside now."
"Well, it is tremendous news, but we shall have to talk about it over and over, in person."
"We're going down and stay a while, you and I."
"That will be very welcome," she sighed. "Yes, I admit I'll enjoy some unfaked shirt-sleeve outdoors, a sea, a salt wind, and our comrades, not images, but real flesh again. How the children must have grown!"
He missed the wistfulness, and not until later did he recall how ardently she entered into the life around her when they touched down. The occasions had been infrequent and brief.
"You must live with the Aloy, work side by side with them, share hardships and dangers as well as victories and celebrations if you would reach an understanding of them and of what they had won on their endless voyage. To him the sacrifices were small.
"Never mind how many years we may have to make ready," he said.
"We'd better begin straight away."
She smiled.
"You mean that you cannot sit still for a cup of tea?"
Ignoring the gentle jibe, he settled before the complex and ordered a beam to Hestia. The ship was at present above the opposite hemisphere, but the Aloy had long since orbited relay satellites. The screen came alight.
"Summoning," said the artificial voice.
A minute passed, and another.
"Summoning."
Yukiko brought up an outside view. The planet shone blue-veined white. Lightnings threaded the darkened edge. She smote hands together.
"We forgot," she cried. "It's night where they are."
"Damn," said Hanno, without remorse.
Svoboda's likeness entered the screen, three-dimensional, as if she herself stood behind a shut window. Her hair was tousled. A robe hastily thrown on gaped over milk-heavy breasts. "What's wrong?" she exclaimed.
"No emergency," Hanno replied. "News. I'll tell you. You tell whoever else got roused, and then go back to sleep if you can."
She bridled. "It couldn't wait.
Listen."
He made his announcement in short, clanging words. "We need to begin studying what information the alloy can give us about these other beings as soon as they've assembled it. Before then, we need to confer. Yukiko and I expect our boat, shortly after sunrise." "What's the matter?"
"What is the hurry?" Svoboda's response crackled. "Aren't you aware this is harvest season? We'll be working ourselves sweatless, people and robots both, for the next several days. We already are. I heard the summons only because I'd just fallen asleep after the baby kept me awake for hours. Now you want us to sweep and garnish quarters for you and meet in instant council."
"Don't you care? Why in hell's name did you sign on?"
"We're sorry," Yukiko interjected. "We were so excited, everything else dropped from our minds. Pardon us."
The other woman fleered.
"Is he sorry?"
"Hold on," Hanno said. "I made a mistake. But this that's happening..." Svoboda cut him off. "Yes, it's important. But so is your arrogance. The main thing you're forgetting is that you, sitting up there in the sky, are not God Almighty."
"Please," Yukiko begged.
Hanno spoke coldly.
"I am the captain. I'll have respect from you."
Svoboda shook her head. A blonde lock tossed on her temple. "That has changed. Nobody is indispensable any longer. We'd accept whatever leader we may need, if we judge that person will serve us well." She paused. "Somebody will call tomorrow when we've conferred and make proper arrangements." With a smile. "Yukiko, this isn't your fault. Everybody knows that. Good night." The screen blanked. Hanno sat staring into it. Yukiko went to stand behind him, a hand on his shoulder. "Don't take this hard," she said. "She was simply short on sleep, therefore short on temper. After she has rested, she will shrug it off." He shook his head.
"No, it goes deeper than that. I hadn't realized. We've been away too much. Down underneath, they carry their resentment yet."
"No, I swear not. No more. You did bring them, us, to something far more wonderful and meaningful than we had dared hope for. It is true. You are not vitally necessary now. Your captaincy is not unquestioned, and you did act thoughtlessly. But the wound is nothing. It will heal by morning."
"Some things never heal." He rose. "Well, no use brooding."
A crooked grin. "What about that cup of tea?" She regarded him in silence before she said, most quietly, "You two can still hurt one another, can you not?" His voice went brusque.
"How often do you miss Dushan?"
He drew her to him.
"Regardless, these have been good years for me. Thank you."
She laid her cheek against his breast. "And for me." He forced a chuckle.
"I repeat, what became of the tea?"
32. First light grayed the east, made dull silver of the stream. Heights westward hulked black, and haze dimmed a sinking huge moon. The waterfall rushed loud down its cliff into the river, which clucked and purled. Coolness blew, laden with silty odors. Hanno and Wanderer stood on the dock. Their tongues felt awkward.
"Well," said Wanderer, "have fun."
"You too," Hanno replied. "How long did you say you'd be gone?"
"Don't know for sure. 3-4 days. But you come home this evening, hear me?"
"Of course. We Phoenicians never spent a night at sea if we could help it."
Wanderer's shadowed countenance darkened further.
"I wish you wouldn't go at all, especially alone. I heard you before. You're going alone yourself and not even taking a communicator along."
"That's different. I know those woods. But none of us really know the waters. We've just puttered around a little in our boats or taken passage with natives. And that was to study the crew, not the seamanship."
"Look, Peregrino, I know perfectly well the conditions aren't identical with Earth.
I've tried them out, remember? Please remember, too, that I was sailing in flimsier vessels than I like thinking about 2,000 years before you were born. Always the second law of the sea is, take care.
What's the first?
It's in the bilge.
They laughed together a bit.
Okay, okay, Wanderer said. So we both need to go walk about in our different ways. I suspect the same's true for Corinne. She didn't really have to confer with the Triune at this exact time.
He left unspoken. Escape, relief, slack off the tension that has built up in us through these past days of wrangling. Shall we abide here? Shall we accompany the Aloy when they leave? Or what? Seek within ourselves for our true desires. We have years yet in which to decide, but the divisions between us have festered longer than that, ranker than we knew.
Thanks for your help, said Hanno. De nada, amigo.
They shook hands. It was the heartiest clasp Hanno had ever felt or given in Hestia. He couldn't ask outright, but he believed Wanderer had altogether forgiven him. Well, whatever rift had occurred was not over something fundamental to the man's life, as for some others. And from Wanderer's viewpoint, events had fairly well vindicated his old friend. At these latest conclaves of the Eight, they had argued side by side. It wasn't the same with Makandal, Patulkius, Aliat, Dushan, Svoboda. Svoboda. Oh, she was perfectly gracious. After all, in principle, she too favored exploring. But by tacit agreement, she and Yukiko stayed abed when their men got up to carry the gear down to the boat. Wanderer turned. His stride whispered over the dock. His tall form strode up the path and disappeared in remnant darknesses. Hanno boarded. Quickly he uncovered and unfurled the mainsail, took the jib from its bag, raised them, cleated the sheets, cast off. The fabric stood ghost-white athwart strengthening dawn, slatted, caught wind, and filled. Ariadne listed over and slipped downstream. She was a sweet little craft, a 6-meter sloop that on Earth would once have been an ocean racer, who there went sailing any more. Built at odd moments by Dushan with robot help according to plans in the database. Mainly he had wanted to make something beautiful as well as purposeful. It turned out that nobody found time to use her much. Finally, not at all. The Ithagene were intrigued, but the layout was wrong for them. Hanno patted the deck beside the cockpit. "Poor girl," he said. "Did you cry sometimes at night, lying always alone? We'll take a real run today, we will." Surprised, he noticed he had spoken in Punic. When had he last? The estuary broadened. Unhindered, the land breeze blew harder. He had it, the current, and the tide to bear him. Ebb should end just about when he reached the sea. Slack water for the transition was desirable. Waves, rips, every kind of turbulence went faster, more forcefully, less foreseeably on Xenogia under its gravity than on Earth. The sun rose ahead, blurred and reddened by overcast, not so far to starboard as it would have been on Earth at this latitude and time of year. Though the planet rotated somewhat faster, the axial tilt promised him a long, long summer day. Cloud banks towered murky in the south. He hoped they wouldn't move northward and rain on him. The wettest season had passed, but you never knew. Xenogian meteorology was still largely guesswork. The parameters were unfamiliar. The humans and their computers had too much else, too much more interesting to consider. Also, it seemed the weather was highly unstable. Chaos, in the physics sense of the word, took over early in any sequence. Well, this was a sturdy, forgiving boat. He and Wanderer had carried down an outboard for her. If he got in bad trouble, he could call, and an aircraft would come take him off. He scowled at the thought. Think about pleasanter things, then. Faring out again among the stars. No, that cut too near. That was what divided the House of the Survivors against itself. You couldn't blame those who wanted to stay. They'd toiled, suffered, wrought mightily. This had become home for them. It was the cosmos for their children. As for those who wanted to quest, why, Manoa, with its multitudinous realms, was only one continent on an entire world. For those who would liefest dwell near non-humans, a whole new race of them was coming. What more dared you wish? Dismiss it for now. Lose yourself in this day.
The sea opened before Ariadne, gunmetal whitecaps, surge and brawl, wind abruptly southeast and stiff. She leaped, leaned, ran happily lee rail under. It throbbed in deck and tiller. The wind sang. Spindrift blew salt kisses. Hanno closed his jacket and drew up its hood against the chill. Fingers brushed the gas cartridge that would at need inflated. Tricky sailing, and his muscles not yet fully retrained to bear his weight. He couldn't have single-handed, were it not for the servos and computer. At that, he must pay constant heed. Good. So did he wish it to be. A native ship was inbound, beating across the wind, a bravery of sails. She must have lain out, waiting for the tide to turn. Now she would ride the flow upstream, doubtless to Xenonosis. Probably she would have to take shelter in one of the bays the Ithagene had dug along the banks, while the boar went rumbling by. It would be especially dangerous today. The moon was both full and close. Northward, some 5 kilometers off the mainland, water churned and jumped white. Black forms reared up. The forbidden ground, a nasty patch of rocks and shoals. A current from the south swept strongly around it. Hanno trimmed his sails. He wanted to be well clear before the incoming tide reinforced that rush. Packing, he made for the nearest of 3 islands that lay dim in the eastern distance. He would scarcely get that far before mid-afternoon. Then prudence dictated he turn back. But it was something to steer by. A goal, he thought. A harbor I won't make. Odysseus, setting forth from ashy Troy for Ithaca, lured by the lotus-eaters, bereaved by the cyclops, at strife with winds and wild men, seduced by an enchantress who took away humanity, descending to the dead, raiding the fields of the sun, passing through the gate of destruction, made captive by her who loved him, cast ashore at Phaeacia. But Odysseus came home at last. How many ports had he, Hanno, failed to make in his millennia? All? Tritus climbed to a breach in the overcast. Light flamed. He sailed on the amethyst sea, and it was strewn with diamond dust, and the manes of the waves blew white. It was as lovely and wild as a woman. Tanithel, her black hair garlanded with anemones, who whispered her wish that she had not had to sacrifice her virginity in the temple before she came to him. Adonia, who read the stars from her tower above Tyre. Twice he cast anchor. The lights of home glimmered through dusk, and then ebb tide bore that country off, and he lay again on empty waters. Afterward, Mirab, Althea, Nirufar, Cordelia, Brangwyn, Torgerd, Maria, Jeanne, Margaret, Natalia, O Ashtoreth, the dear ghosts were beyond counting or remembering. But had they ever been much more than ghosts, belonging as they did to death? To men he felt closer. They could not bear the same thing off with them. Baalram, Thuti, Umlele, Pythias, Ezra, rough old Rufus, yes, that hurt. Somewhere inside himself, Hanno had forever mourned Rufus. Stop sniveling. The wind skirled louder. Ariadne heeled sharply. The sun disappeared behind gray, beneath which wrack began to fly. Cloud masses bulked mountainous, drawing closer. Lightning sprang about in their blue-black caverns. The islands were lost in scud haze. The mainland aft lay low and vague. What time is it? Hanno asked. He whistled when the computer told him. His body had sailed for him, while his mind drifted awash in the past, longer than he knew. He'd grown hungry, too, without noticing, but would be rash to trust the helm to the machinery, even to duck below and fix a sandwich. "Give me Hestia," he ordered the communicator. "Summoning." "Hello, hello, is anybody there?" "Hanno calling." Wind tore Yukiko's voice from the speaker, seas trampled its tatters underfoot. He barely heard, "Frightened for you. Satellite report. Weather moving faster and faster. Please." "Yes, certainly. I'll return. Don't worry. This boat can take a knockdown and right herself. I'll be back for supper." "If I catch the tide right. Got to keep well offshore till I can run straight down the slot. Well, the motor has plenty of kilowatts. Better that to claw off with than men rowing till their hearts burst. He didn't want to use it unless and until he must. He needed a fight, wits and nerve as well as sinews against the wolf gods. Coming around was a long and tough maneuver. Once a wave smashed clear across the deck. Ariadne shuddered, but still her mast swayed on high, an uplifted lance. Gallant girl, like Svoboda. Like all of them, Yukiko, Corinne, Aliat, all of them survivors in ways their men had never had to be. He did let the servos keep the tiller while he shortened sail. A sheet escaped his grasp and slashed his wrist before he captured and cleated it. Spume washed the blood off. The world had gone dark, driving gray, save for the lightning flashes southward. Water swung to and fro in the cockpit till the pump flung it overside. He remembered bailing Pythia's ship during a Baltic storm. As he took the helm back, a song abruptly lilted through his head. "Oh, hand me down my walking cane!" Where had it come from? English language, old, old, 19th or early 20th century. Impudent, a pulsing railroad kind of tune. "Oh, mama, come go my bail. Get me out of this goddamn jail. All my sins are taken away." Railroad, the West. A world that had seemed boundless but lost its horizons and itself in a blink of centuries, and was one with Troy. Then some looked starboard and dreamed of new America. The upshot? Machines, eight human beings, immensities as impassable and unanswering as death. "Oh, hell is deep and hell is wide. Oh, hell is deep and hell is wide. Oh, hell is deep and hell is wide. Ain't got no bottom, ain't got no side. All my sins are taken away." Hanno showed the wind his teeth. Odysseus went there and won back. If the stars held no new America, they offered what was infinitely more. The noise rammed him. It was a monstrous rush and boom, pierced by a risen screech. To port, the cloud wall had vanished behind a whiteness that overran waves and kilometers. "Strike sail!" he bawled. That was not merely a gale, that was a line squall come from behind sight and bound for him. Weather on Xenogea heeded no law of Grecian Aeolus. Wind speeds were commonly low, but when they did go high, they bore twice the weight of violent air. His left hand took the switch that lowered the outboard. "Point bows into seas and hold them fast." The fist smote. Rain flayed and blinded. Waves topped the rails. Ariadne climbed, swayed amidst cataracting foam, plunged into troughs. Hanno clung. Something snatched him. He was down in roaring black. He whirled and tumbled. At the middle of it rested a cold steadiness. His mind. "I'm overboard," he knew. "Inflate the jacket. Don't breathe water or you're done." He broke surface, gasped air full of rain and salt foam, threshed limbs against heaviness that tore. The hood swelled into a pillow-like collar, upbearing his head as the rest of the garment floated his body. He squinted about. Where was the boat? No sign of her. He didn't think she'd gone under, not that staunch little lady. But wind and waves must have borne her from him. Maybe not very far as yet. Far enough, though, when he could see only the billows savaging him. What had happened? His brain cleared, shook off shock, became a computer program to calculate survival. Wind might have caught the unfurled loose mainsail, swung the hull around, shoved it so low that a broaching sea swept him out. Well, if he kept alert, he'd drift free till rescue came. That should be soon after this flaw of weather had passed. Yukiko was probably trying right now to call him. An aircraft, those carried aboard Pythias, were designed for Phaeacia. They flew on Xenogea, but it was rather precarious. Given conditions at all unusual, you needed a human pilot as well as the machine. Maybe the Hestia folk should have ordered modifications, but the job was big. They had so much else on hand. They could stay aground when in doubt. Pilots. Wanderers the best. I think that's generally agreed. He's out of touch today. Otherwise, Svoboda. She's got her kid to think about. The colony is tiny, a beachhead on a shore not made for our kind. She has no right to risk herself needlessly. Of course, she will take off the moment it looks practical, which should be when this gust is over. High winds aren't an unacceptable hazard in themselves, if they're reasonably steady. The trick will be to stay alive till then. Exposure is the enemy. This water isn't too cold. It's a warm current from the south. However, a few degrees below skin temperature will suck the heat out in time. I remember, but that was on another voyage, and besides, the men are dead. I also know some ancient Asian ways of controlling blood flow. At dire need, I can call up my ultimate reserves while they last. Swim. Save your strength, but do not let yourself be rolled about and smothered. Find the rhythms. Who was it? What goddess who lived at the bottom of the sea and spread her nets for sailor men? Oh, yes, Ran of the Norse. Shall we dance, my lady Ran? Wind screamed, seas crashed. How long had this gone on? No telling. The minute could amount to an hour. Reverse time dilation, the cosmos flying away from a man. He'd been mistaken about the blow. It wasn't any quick squall. Though rain had thinned, the wind raved wilder. Unforeseen, unforeseeable, as ignorant as men, and, yes, their smug machines still were. The universe held as many surprises as it did stars. No more. That was its glory. But some day one of them was bound to kill you. Thunder ahead. Hanno rose onto a crest. He saw black teeth, the rocks and skerries, the forbidden ground. Water seethed, geysered, exploded. The current had swept him to this. Flashingly, he hoped Ariadne remained free, for her people to recover. He readied himself. It was hard to do. A sense of warmth in hands and feet crept treacherously toward his breast. He knew that consciousness was dimming. He couldn't tell which lights had by now gone out. A comber took him along. He smashed into the white. White. He lay on stone. Weed wrapped him, yellow-brown ropes. Waves roiled and roared under a low-flying sky. Oftener and oftener water rushed over the roughness beneath him. He would inhale it, choke, cough, reach for air. He scarcely noticed. Cold, pain, struggle were of the world, the storm. Impersonal he watched them, like a man drowsy at his hearthside watching flames. The rising tide would claim him, but he would not be here. He would be... where? What? He didn't know. It didn't matter. So this is how it ends. Not too bad a way for an old sailor man. I do wish I could lie remembering, but memory slips from me. Wishing does. Being does. Farewell. Farewell, you ghosts. Fare always well. A flickering whine through wind and surf, a shadow, a shape, a jolt that awakens awareness. You fool, he raged dimly. Go back. You could lose your life. The aircraft bucked and rocked, fell, climbed, did battle. From its teardrop snaked a line. The cord passed half a meter above Hanno. His hand tried to reach and grab it, but couldn't. It whirled on past, again, again. It withdrew. The engine overhead snarled louder. The line descended afresh. A loop was at the end for the feet of a clinging man. Dushan hit the reef. He took the impact in his muscles, got his foothold, stood while a surge ran ankle-deep around him. With his left hand he kept hold of the line, and he advanced step by gripping step. The strongest among us, thought Hanno bewilderedly, but I've been all this time with his woman. Dushan's right arm went under his shoulders, raised him, held him fast. The aircraft winched the line in. They swung like a bell-clapper. Proclaim liberty throughout the world! They were aboard. Svoboda gained altitude and made for shore. Dushan laid Hanno out in the aisle, which shivered and banged. He examined him with rough skill. Slight concussion, I think, he growled. Maybe a broken rib or two. Mainly a bad chill, hypothermia. He'll live. He administered initial treatment. Blood quickened. Svoboda brought the aircraft slanting down. How did you know? Hanno mumbled. Yukiko called the alloy, Svoboda said from the controls. Rain dashed across the view screen before her. They couldn't enter atmosphere themselves. Even their robots have trouble in bad weather. But they sent a spaceboat on low trajectory. Its detectors registered an infrared anomaly in the rocks. That was where you might well be. You shouldn't have. You shouldn't.
She made a near-vertical descent. Contact jarred the machine. She snapped off her harness and came to kneel beside him.
Did you think we'd want to be without you? She asked. Did we ever?
33. Seldom was a day this brilliant. Sunlight spilled from a sky in which clouds were blue-shadowed white, like enormous snowbanks. It gleamed off wings cruising aloft. Glimpses of river and sea shone molten. The eight seated around a planked table were thinly clad. From the top of their knoll, vision ranged between Hestia, at its distance a toy box, westward to where Mount Pythias rose pure beyond the hills. "Twice before have we met this way, in open air," remembered Hanno. "Do we have some unknown need?" "Yes, the reasons are practical. Be undistracted. Leave the children in care of the robots for these few hours, and hope that fresh surroundings will freshen our thinking. But do our souls believe that when we most want wisdom, we must seek it from earth and heaven? They are not ours even now. This close-knit turf that is not grass, yonder squat trees and serpentine bushes, somber hues of everything that grows, sharp fragrances, the very taste of spring water, none came from the womb of Gia. Nor can any of it ever truly become hers, nor should it." The looks upon him were expectant. He cleared his throat and sat straighter. The motion hurt. His injuries were not yet entirely healed, but he ignored that. "I won't ask for a vote today," he said. "We have years ahead before we must commit ourselves, but my news may change some minds." Unless that had already happened. Certainly it had done so as regarded him. He didn't know whether his near death had been necessary to snuff out the last rancor. Maybe that would have faded away in time. But maybe it would have smoldered on and on, eating hearts hollow. No matter. The fellowship was whole again. Little had been spoken outright. Everything had been felt. He had an intuition, moreover, that in typical irrational human fashion this was in turn catalyzing another oneness. "We'll see," he thought. "All of us." "As you know," he went on, "Yukiko and I have been communicating a lot with the Aloy these past few days. They've reached a decision of their own." He raised a hand against anxiety. "Nothing radical except in what it can mean for the long haul. They will stay on till the new ship arrives, and for several years afterward. There'll be an unforeknowably great deal of information to exchange and, well, rapport to build and enjoy. In due course, though, the Aloy are going elsewhere. What's new is, if we at that time leave for Phaeacia, they will come with us." He and his partners smiled into the amazement, savored it. "In God's name, why?" exclaimed Patulcius. "What have they to gain there?" "Knowledge, to start with," Hanno answered. "A whole different set of planets." "But planetary systems are common enough," Wanderer said. "I thought that what interests them most is intelligent life." "True," Yukiko told them. "At Phaeacia, that will be us, and for us they will be." "They want to know us better," Hanno said. "They see tremendous potential in our race, far more than in the Ethagene, much though they've gotten from them in the way of scientific discovery and artistic inspiration. We are spacefarers, too. The odds are the Ethagene never will be, none of them, at best in the remote future." "But the Aloy need only stay here, and they can observe both races and interact with that other set of travelers to boot," Patulcius argued. Yukiko shook her head. "They do not expect we can or will remain. Certainly our numbers could only grow slowly and never become large on Xenogia. And therefore what we humans in space were able to do, or at last cared to do, would be hopelessly limited. You six, no, we eight, have been like the English Puritans on Earth," Hanno said. "Looking for a home, they meant to settle in Virginia, but weather drove them north and they ended in New England. It wasn't what they'd hoped for, but they made the best of it, and that's how the Yankees came to be. Suppose New England had been all there ever was for them. Think of such a country, stagnant, poor, narrow, and narrow-minded. Do you want that for yourselves and your children?" "The Yankees put down strong roots," Dushan responded.
They did have America beyond. We have nothing like that, Makandal said. Xenogia belongs to its people. We have no right to anything but this little patch they gave us. If we took more, God ought to strike us down. Wanderer nodded.
So you have often said, dear, Patulcius demurred, and I have tried to point out that as a practical matter. Yes, we have our investment here, Svoboda interrupted. Sweat and tears and dreams, it will hurt to scrap that. But I always believed myself that someday we must.
Her voice clanged. And now we've been given this opportunity.
That's it, Hanno chimed in. Phaeacia has no natives for us to harm. It seems to be almost a reborn Earth. Seems. Maybe it's a death trap. We can't know till we've tried. We understood the risk of failure, extinction. Well, with the alloy at our backs, that won't happen. United, we can overcome anything. You see, they want us to live, to flourish. They want humans among the stars.
Why us? Asked Makandal. I realize our psyches, our special talents, we and they doing more, becoming more, than either could alone. Like a good marriage. But if they'd like human company, why not go on to Earth?
Have you forgotten why? Retorted Hanno grimly.
Her eyes widened, fingers touched lips.
How can they be sure? They aren't, not absolutely. But from what we've described, they can guess with pretty high probability. Earth is going the self-same way Pegasi did, and the rest that they know about. Oh, we'll swap messages with it, no doubt. But it's too far off.
A galactically minuscule 4 1/3 light centuries. To make the voyage appear worthwhile, the alloy would rather help us get established, come really to know us, and finally plan ventures together.
Dushan gazed upward. Phaeacia, he breathed. Like Earth. Not truly, but green leaves, rich soil, clear skies.
He closed his eyes against the sun and let its warmth lave his face.
Most nights we will see stars.
Patulcius shifted about on the bench.
This does put quite a different complexion on matters, he admitted.
As much eagerness as his heavy features ever showed danced across them.
The survival of more than simply us, of humanity, true humanity.
It blazed from Wanderer.
Not just a settlement or nation, a base, a frontier camp.
We can be patient, we and the alloy. We can make the planet ours, raise generations of young, till we're many and strong. But then we'll go to space again.
Those of you who wish, said Dushan.
Makandal's tone shook. To learn and to grow. To keep life alive. Aliat spoke through sudden, brief tears.
Yes, take the universe back from the damned machines.
Where are they? The story is that Enrico Fermi first raised the question in the 20th century, when scientists first dared wonder publicly about such things. If other thinking beings than us existed, how strange and sad if none did. In the entire vastness and diversity of creation, why had we on Earth found no trace or track of them? There we were, on the verge of making our own starward leap. Had nobody gone before us? Perhaps it was impractical or impossible for flesh and blood. It certainly was not for machines we knew in principle how to make. They could be our explorers, sending home their findings. Reaching far planets, they could build more like themselves. Instilling the same imperative, discover. No menace to life in their proliferation. At any given sun, a few tons of raw material from some barren asteroid or moon would suffice. Under conservative assumptions, calculations showed that such robots would spread from end to end of the galaxy in about 1 million years. That was the merest eye-blink of cosmic time. Why, 1 million years ago, our ancestors were approaching full humanness. Had no race anywhere even that much of a head start. All it would take was one. Still easier to send were signals. We tried. We listened. Silence. Until we thought to try in certain new directions. Then enigma. Guesses teemed. The others were transmitting, but not by means that we yet knew. They had come here, but in the prehistoric past. They were here, but concealed. They destroyed themselves as we feared we might before they could send or go. They had no high technological civilizations among them. Ours was unique. They did not exist. We were indeed alone. Fermi went to his grave. Time blew onward through its night. Humankind entered upon a new path of evolution. The answer to his question was less found than it was created by what the children of Earth themselves did, and it proved to be twofold. Dispatch your robots. They go forth to marvels and magnificences. Every star is a sun, every planet a world, multifarious, astounding, its secrets not exhaustible in less than many decades. When it bears life, they are inexhaustible forever, because life is not only infinite in its variousness, it never remains the same, it is forever changing. When it is intelligent, this rises to a whole new dimensionality, a different order of being. The farther your emissaries range, the faster grows the realm of the unknown. Double the radius, and you roughly octuple the number of stars to ransack. You also double the time of faring and the time for a signal to cross between ship and home. 10 or 12 years from departure to arrival, 10 years more to receive the first recounting, are reasonable. 50 years are not unreasonable, but 100 or 200 or 500 years either way. Suns and planets have fallen into classes. They no longer hold revelations. If you know the basic parameters, you can compute their properties. It is pointless to lengthen your list of them. Life forms are something else. Yet, if you desire to study these, you have a sufficiency on worlds already attained. Indeed, you have overwhelmingly much. Your information processing capabilities, that part of them devoted to this endeavor, grow saturated. The data include data on sapient beings. Those are rare, but they do occur and are fascinating beyond measure. Nevertheless, when the time lag grows much greater than lifetimes of theirs, and moreover your field scientists are machines, how can you truly come to know them? Those that have been found are primitive and mortal. Science and high technology result from chains of unlikely historical accidents. Wiser to hold your attention on those near enough that you can, to some limited extent, follow what the robots do and observe. There is no precise limit. There is simply a radius, on the order of a light century or two, beyond which it is unprofitable to search farther. Having foreseen this, you have never built self-multiplying von Neumann machines. Exceptions exist. When your instruments detect the radiations that suggest a civilization at some star, you will send your beams and perhaps your robots. But the span until anything can come of that, if anything does, is multi-millennial. At the end, will your race still care? Other exceptions are cosmic, astrophysical, extraordinary stars, clouds, where stars are coming to birth, recent supernovae, black holes in peculiar circumstances, the monstrosities at the core of the galaxy, and comparable rarities. You will dispatch your observers that far, 30,000 light-years from Sol to galactic center, and wait. All of the few star-faring civilizations will do likewise. Therefore, all that have reached these goals will beamcast from them in hopes of making contact. They will wait. All have become entities that can wait. Here is the second half of the solution to the riddle. It is not sentient organic life that the robots seek to summon. It is other robots. Machines do not conquer their mother worlds. They gently, gradually absorb their creators into their systems at the wish of those beings whose overmatching physical and intellectual superiors they have become. Then, in the course of time, more and more they direct their attention from mere life toward problems and undertakings they find worthy of themselves. When the original thinking animals live on, as happens occasionally, it is because they too have turned their concerns elsewhere, inward, searching for joys and fulfillments, or possibly imaginary enlightenments, toward which no machine can aid them, realms quite outside the universe of the stars. No, said Svoboda. We do wrong if we feel hostile. Postbiotic evolution is nevertheless evolution, reality finding newness in itself. She colored and laughed. Oh, but that sounds pretentious. I only meant that the advanced, independent robots are no threat to us. We'll continue keeping robots of our own. We have to, but for purposes of our own. We'll do what the postbiotics not only don't care to do anymore, they never really could. That's to deal with life of our kind, the old kind, not by peering and listening, centuries between question and answer, but by being there ourselves, sharing, yes, loving. And so we'll come to understand what we can't now imagine. Those of you who choose to be seekers. Patulkia's remark fell doubly dry after her torrenting enthusiasm. Like Dushan, I shall cultivate my garden. I dare say most of our descendants will so prefer. No doubt, Hanno said. That's fine. They'll be our reserve. Peregrino's right. Some will always want more than that. The Phaeacians won't settle down into rustic innocence, Macandal predicted. They can't, if they aren't to go the way of Earth, and that would make their whole effort meaningless, wouldn't it? They'll have to find some new path for themselves. They'll have to evolve, too. And those of us in space will, along our own lines, Wanderer added. Not in body, in genes. I aim to be around for a mighty long spell. In our minds, our spirits. Yukiko smiled. The stars and their worlds for our teachers. Earnestly. But let us remember what a hard school that will be. Today we count for nothing. Every crew of starfarers the Aloy have any knowledge of, and they are less than a dozen, are like us, leftovers, malcontents, atavisms, outcasts. I know. I don't admit we count for nothing, though. We are. Yes. And if we are wise, if we can humble ourselves enough to hear what the lowliest of living beings have to tell us, at last we will meet the postbiotics as equals. In a million years? I don't know. But when we are ready, it will be as you said. We will have become something other than what we are now. Hanno nodded. I wonder if at the end we and our allies won't be more than the equals of the machines. His comrades regarded him a little puzzled. I've been playing with an idea, he explained. It seems to have worked this way on Earth, and what we've seen here and heard from the Aloy suggests it may be a general principle. No steps in evolution haven't been triumphal advances. No, the failures of the earlier stages made them, the desperate ones, in Yukiko's words, the atavisms and outcasts. Why should a fish doing well in the water struggle onto the land? It was those that couldn't compete that did it, because they had to go somewhere else or die. And the ancestors of the reptiles were forced out of the amphibian swamps, the birds forced into the air, and mammals forced to find niches where the dinosaurs weren't, and certain apes forced out of the trees, and we Phoenicians held only a thin strip of territory, so we took to the sea. And hardly anybody went to America or Australia who was comfortable at home in Europe. Well, we'll see. We'll see. A million years, you guessed, Yukiko. He laughed. Shall we make a date? 1 million years from this day, we'll all meet again and remember. First, we must survive, said Patulkius. Surviving is what we're good at, replied Wanderer. Macandal sighed. So far. Let's not wax overconfident. No guarantees. Never were, never will be. 1 million years are a lot of days and nights to get through. Can we? We shall try, said Dushan. Together, vowed Svoboda. Then we'd better learn, said Aliat. Better than before. How to share. 34. The ships departed, Pythias and friend. For a while, some months, until speeds grew too high, word went between them, imagery, love. Rites celebrated the mysteries of community and communion, for everywhere around them thronged suns. When I consider thy heavens, the work of thy fingers, the moon and the stars, which thou hast ordained, what is man that thou art mindful of him? Hannah and Svoboda stood in the darkened command center looking out. Through clasped hands, they felt each other's nearness and warmth.
"Is this why we were born?" she whispered.
"We'll make it be," he promised.
Chronology. Except for the first, all dates are Anno Domini. Each is the year in which its chapter begins. Occasionally, the narrative thereafter moves forward or backward in time. Chapter 1, Thule, 310 B.C. Chapter 2, The Peaches of Forever, 19. Chapter 3, The Comrade, 359. Chapter 4, Death in Palmyra, 641. Chapter 5, No Man Shuns His Doom, 998. Chapter 6, Encounter, 1050. Chapter 7, The Same Kind, 1072. Chapter 8, Lady in Waiting, 1221. Chapter 9, Ghosts, 1239. Chapter 10, In the Hills, 1570. Chapter 11, The Kitten and the Cardinal, 1640. Chapter 12, The Last Medicine, 1710. Chapter 13, Follow the Drinking Gourd, 1855. Chapter 14, Men of Peace, 1872. Chapter 15, Coming Together, 1931. Chapter 16, Niche, 1938. Chapter 17, Steel, 1942. Chapter 18, Judgment Day, 1975. Chapter 19, Thule, ? Glossary. Chinese names are transcribed according to the Wade-Giles system. This probably remains somewhat more familiar to Anglophone readers than Pinyin or Yale, and is no more inaccurate a rendition of ancient or regional pronunciations. Armorica, Brittany. Veritas, Beirut. Bravalier, probably near modern Norrköping, Sweden. Britannia, England and Wales. Brdigala, Bordeaux. Chang'an, near modern Xi'an, S-I-A-N, Pinyin, X-I-A-N. Constantinople, Istanbul. Damasic, Damascus. Dumnonia, Cornwall and Devon. Dorinais, the river Dordogne. Emesa, Homs. Falernia, an area in the region of Naples, anciently noted for its wines. Gadira, Cadiz. Latin, Gades. Semitic, Agadir. Gallia, Gaul. France, with parts of Belgium, Germany, and Switzerland. Gartariki, Western Russia. Garumna, the river Garonne. Gautland, southern Sweden, apparently between Scania and Lake Vänern. Heankyo, Kyoto. Hydra, Lara in Denmark. Kalep, Aleppo. Kyiv, Kiev. Lakota, Dakota, Sioux. Lugdunensis, a province in Gaul, comprising most of northern and a fair portion of central France. Lugdunum, Lyon. Mecca, Mecca. Massalia, Marseille, Latin, Massilia. Medinat Rasul Allah, Medina. Nidaros, Trondheim in Norway. Pariki, Pawnee. Peking, Beijing. Poitou, former French province, now divided into the departments of La Vendée, de Sèvres, and Vienne. Britannia, Britain, including Scotland. Sore, Tyre. Stalingrad, Volgograd. Syria, a province of the Roman, later the East Roman or Byzantine, Empire, approximately the same as the modern country. Tadmor, Palmyra, in Syria. Tartessus, southwestern Iberia, conjectural. Thule, southern Norway, conjectural. Tripolis, Tripoli, in Lebanon, also known anciently as Tarabulus. Wendland, a region bordering on the southern Baltic shores. Wichita Mountains, in southwestern Oklahoma.
Yathrib, original name of Medina.
End of The Boat of a Million Years by Paul Anderson, narrated by Mitzi Friedlander in the studios of the American Printing House for the Blind, Louisville, Kentucky, for the Library of Congress, June 1991. For special distribution as authorized by Act of Congress under Public Law 89-522, with the permission of the copyright holder and the publisher, Tom Doherty Associates, Incorporated, 49 West 24th Street, New York, New York, 10010,